Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Did you happen to notice that the same big number popped up in two different news items in the last few days? The number $18 billion. That's how much President Trump requested from Congress on Friday for a 10-year plan to build the Mexican border wall. And it's the number Mayor de Blasio mentions when asked about New York City public housing residents who didn't have heat during the intense cold snap we just had. With federal divestment over the years from what used to be largely federal public housing, that's how much the city now says they need to find somehow to make NYCHA buildings whole again from various states of disrepair. So that's a direct contrast. Choose upsides or propose a compromise. $18 billion for a border wall or $18 billion to fix the homes in New York City where people live. And that brings us to a meeting scheduled for this morning between President Trump and bipartisan leaders from the Senate, with the very immediate but very thorny goal of coming up with a government spending bill by next Friday, January 19th, when the government would largely shut down if they can't strike a deal. The new border wall funding request is part of that, while we wait for Mexico to pay for it, of course. The Democrats, of course, want a permanent DACA fix as their immigration priority, something to allow the young adults who grew up in this country but were brought here illegally by their parents as kids to stay legally. The DACA program expires in March. So that's already a tricky starting point for budget talks that are even more complex than that. And with that as a starting point, we welcome NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell. Thanks for coming on, Kelsey. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can we start with the border wall funding? The president campaigned on the idea that Mexico would pay for the wall. Where did this $18 billion from U.S. taxpayers come from? Why that number?
This number has been floating around for some time as the number that they would need over 10 years to complete work on the wall that Trump has proposed. For some time, it looked like Congress was talking about a much, much smaller amount of money to include in a broader immigration and spending package that would address, as you mentioned, DACA recipients. We often kind of call them dreamers. The idea was that the $18 billion would do the full wall. Congress wanted to do something less, and it was a bit of a surprise that the administration came in after a couple of months of negotiations and brought back up this $18 billion number. It seems to have kind of put a damper on the talks, and the people that I've talked to today say that things are slowing down and that they're hoping to have a breakthrough today, though it's possible that these talks will stretch out past this week.
Politically speaking, is the $18 billion border wall number being seen as a negotiation starting point for some kind of border security that the Democrats might agree to that's not as politically toxic as a wall in exchange for DACA, or more of a poison pill from the president to make a deal impossible and activate the Republican base to blame the Democrats during the these midterm elections?
Well, it's hard to say at this point because the people that I've spoken with say that they don't exactly know where the number came from the White House. It's important to say that these talks have been happening in Congress for some time, 2 months roughly. Dozens of meetings have already happened about a combination of enforcement techniques and some changes. Typically, when we think about border enforcement that Democrats are in favor of, it would involve things like drones and sensors and fencing and repairs to existing structures, not necessarily walls, but often fences along the border. So there have been a lot of talks about funding those priorities for 2 months, and Democrats have been very open to doing that. So this number from the White House is a little bit of a diversion, according to those people I've spoken with.
Can you see, and can other political analysts in Washington see, the potential outlines of a deal that would include DACA by next Friday?
It would be very difficult. Senate Minority Whip John Cornyn acknowledged that this would be very difficult. I'm sorry, Senate Majority Whip John Cornyn acknowledged that this would be quite difficult. It is possible, though, that they could decide to get a short-term spending bill, something that extends current spending levels for a few more weeks, maybe a month, to allow them to finish these negotiations, because they very much are fixated on the idea that they need to combine the whatever this immigration DACA package is with the spending bill that needs to be done.
Nancy Pelosi said to reporters yesterday that the Democrats are open to negotiation in general on immigration and on spending. But Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said this yesterday on the Senate floor, and you will hear him refer to the DACA issue as the DREAM Act.
So I ask several questions. Why won't Democratic leadership negotiate with us? Because we refuse to simply pass what's referred to as a DREAM Act, as is, with no proportional border security and interior enforcement measures. As the Democrats see it, it's take it or leave it, their way or the highway. This isn't good faith. This isn't negotiating. And that approach is doomed to failure.
Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa on the Senate floor yesterday. My guest is NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. And we can take phone calls for her on any of this or anything related at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So, Kelsey, what are the politics and the truth, if you can find it, behind Pelosi saying, here we are, we're ready to negotiate, let's negotiate, and Chuck Grassley going out there and saying, the Democrats are refusing to negotiate?
Well, we also heard Grassley say that this is not a negotiation, when in fact both of them are using very, very, very common negotiating tactics of publicly staking out very strong positions that speak to an electoral base or kind of don't allow people to see what their cards are in the negotiation, and then working through their staff or through other channels to work out a deal so that they can come away and say, I worked as hard as I possibly could for the priorities I laid out, and here's the middle ground that we were able to reach. So this is a very common tactic in politics. It's actually a very common tactic in even business negotiations. It can feel scary when it's something where it is related to people's lives and when it's related to funding the government.
By the way, why is DACA part of the spending bill process in the first place? DACA is a policy item, really, right? A legal status declaration item, not a spending item per se. Or am I missing something?
Right. It is definitely that. And there are a couple of reasons why they're trying to do this. One is that, as Grassley pointed out, Republicans are asking for corresponding enforcement and changes in spending, basically, on Homeland Security side, on immigration side. And so when they were making the decision to deal with DACA, because when the president rescinded what is called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that program that was created by President Obama, when President Trump decided to rescind that, there was a decision made that they would do what is called the DREAM Act. The DREAM Act is actually something entirely separate. It's a piece of legislation that was worked out by a bipartisan group of senators. And they needed to find a way to meld the DREAM Act with the spending that Republicans were asking for. So putting those two together made it much easier for that to happen. It's also a negotiating tactic. When you have a big bunch of politically difficult things to get done here in Congress, oftentimes leaders will decide to put them together so that when people go vote, when members in the House in particular go vote, they can find something they like in the bill to vote for. They can ignore the things that might be unpalatable or might not work for their political base, but they can vote for the things they do like. And by doing that, they can kind of build a coalition of people to get something passed.
Would it be fair to say that despite other serious disagreements on immigration, that a majority of members of Congress from both parties want a DACA fix? The Dreamers are pretty sympathetic in general. Even Trump says, of course, he says different things at different times, but he tends to say he wants a fix for the Dreamers. Even as anti-immigration as he is, he finds this a sympathetic population.
Yeah, absolutely. The vast majority of lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, want to find some sort of suitable situation that will deal with this. But the problem is that it is tied up in some of this border enforcement, and they aren't exactly sure how much Republicans are willing to give on the protection side, and Democrats are having a hard time deciding how much they're willing to give on the border enforcement side.
Does the new weakening of Steve Bannon politically because of the Michael Wolff book play any role here? Bannon, of course, leads the anti-immigrant wing of the Republican base in a certain way. Or does Trump have that as central enough to his political identity without Bannon that the fallout from the book doesn't matter to this issue?
I haven't seen much of a reaction to the Bannon situation up here on the Hill, save for the fact that, you know, the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, said that he was happy with the president's remarks about Bannon when he disassociated himself with his former advisor. It is not as pronounced on the Hill as it might be within the White House.
212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, if you want to talk to NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell this morning, and Danny in Cornwall does. Danny, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the overtly racist policy of the Trump administration, and basically the Democrats' only lever is to shut the government down. How are they going to put a check on what the Trump administration is doing, even though there's a lot of visa overstay from Western European countries?
Really great question. You know, we've spent a year now talking about whether the Democrats should normalize Trump by doing any business with him, and that aversion to normalization, as you know, Kelsey, is rooted in what is seen as Trump's racism and sexism and nativism. And if they do business on ordinary things, some Democrats say, then that lets Trump get away with those really heinous sins in terms of what the president of the United States should be rooted in. And so you normalize racism, sexism, nativism, authoritarianism by doing deals as usual on almost anything. And so Danny calls in and says, well, maybe the only leverage the Democrats have over Trump's racism is to shut the government down. Is this an active conversation among Democrats in Congress, or more only out in the Democratic grassroots?
There are people who raise the specter of a shutdown, but to be clear, within the governing ranks of the Democratic Party, there's an understanding that governing means governing and running the government. And running the government means keeping it open. And a threat of a shutdown is only effective if the other side views it as a negative issue. And the president says that he said last year that he could see the potential for a good kind of shutdown. So it is not the type of conversation that people on the Hill are really having, because Democrats want to credibly say that they ran the government and that they stood up and they did their jobs, even in a politically difficult environment, and they view themselves as having been elected to run the government.
Carolyn Fairfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My concern is, where does this begin and end? I support us giving citizenship to people who have come here and have gotten education, have qualified jobs, as did family members of mine generations ago. But I am concerned, where does it stop? For instance, we know of people who are working for the federal government in private industry who have been operating on green cards for decades, who have had families here, who are contributing, who thought they had a choice. And now, are we going to impact their lives? Where they have been contributing to it?
I'm not sure I understand the question. What's the relationship between DACA and those other people who've been here with green cards working that you're bringing up?
Exactly.
That's my question, is what's the relationship between those two? Why do we need to bring those other immigrants into a DACA conversation?
Because the federal government is saying they want to settle a lot of these immigration issues. So I wonder where they're going to begin, where they're going to end. I am concerned for people who have been contributing, and especially these young people.
Yes.
But I know it goes back to generations that are older.
Carol, thank you very much. Well, if you have a green card, then you're pretty much safe. But Kelsey, another big immigration story in the news today, if I can use Carol's question as a way to bring this in, is the Trump administration announcing an end to temporary protected status for 200,000 Salvadorans in the country since 2001 or earlier. they don't have green cards. They have this TPS. And now they're all going to have to be deported or leave voluntarily in the next 18 months. 200,000 people who've been here at least 17 years. And that means many of them have children who are born American citizens and a lot of family separation. Again, for 200,000 Salvadorans who were here before the earthquakes of 2001 and allowed to stay under temporary protected status. People, I think, misunderstand TPS sometimes as, oh, well, we just let anybody from Haiti come after the earthquake there. We just let anybody from El Salvador come after the earthquakes there. There were two in consecutive months in 2001. It's not that. It's people who are already here, who the government didn't force to go back into really difficult situations. So President Bush extended the TPS for Salvadorans a number of times. Then President Obama did. Well, it's all added up to 17 years now for people who've been in the country for more than 17 years. And the Trump administration says, okay, nope, they've recovered from the earthquakes, so we're going to kick you out in the next 18 months. I'm telling the Salvadoran TPS story in a little more detail than you need to hear, Kelsey. But does that become an issue in the spending and DACA deal making that's going on between now and next Friday, or is it an entirely separate immigration issue?
I haven't spoken with any of the negotiators about this directly, but I would point out that they're having a difficult time with the DACA portion of this, and the hope and the goal of all of this was to focus on DACA. So it would be difficult to add that in there if that became part of the conversation.
And they don't need Congress to end TPS. I mean, technically, they don't need Congress to end DACA either. But Trump, I think, is trying to save DACA, but get a lot out of it. Or dangle DACA.
Well, to be clear, DACA was an executive order, so it was fully within the executive privilege to rescind it. And Trump said at the time that he was rescinding it because he thought that for it to have legal and permanent value, it had to be done through the legislature.
Right. So the Republicans always considered DACA unconstitutional because they said President Obama was overstepping the bounds of executive authority on a piece of immigration policy that really is for immigration law. And Trump stood by that Republican talking point when he got into office and ended DACA as an executive program. So he threw it into Congress's lap in the way that you say. He's not trying to do anything like that with TPS. He just wants to kick those Salvadorans and Haitians and others who are covered by TPS out. So it doesn't become a congressional issue in that same way. I want to bring up a few other issues which are also really important that also would need to get resolved by next Friday to avoid a government shutdown. And I'm going to let Michael in Manhattan, who's calling on one of them, bring this up. Michael, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you, Brian. Love your show.
Thank you.
I called your screener because of the CHIPS program. I mean, most of the, we're talking about young children, and as many, I think there's like, there have been reports of like 700,000 DACA people who are, I would assume in general, because that they may be a good people, but there are, we're talking about a millions, or at least over a million young kids who need medical care.
Right. And thank you, Michael. And it is many millions. Kelsey, I don't know if you have that number at your fingertips. I don't. But the Children's Health Insurance Program, acronym CHIP, which so many millions, it is many millions of American kids get their health insurance from, but which expired last month with just some stopgap funding in place now, but some states already sending notices that they won't sign up new kids. Is the CHIP program part of these January 19th spending bill talks?
It is part of the talks. So it expired, but it also was extended through, the funding extended it. It is a very bipartisan issue, and when I mentioned that they are trying to put these things together in a big package in order to kind of appeal to a larger number of members of Congress. CHIP is part of that. The idea is that it is a bipartisan thing, and it's something that appeals to a lot of people and something that there's a strong will to have renewed. And the expectation is that it will be added into this and that funding will continue to flow to that program.
If they kick the can down the road on DACA with a short-term spending bill that expires before DACA does in March, and then they'll revisit it, does it at least seem very likely that they'll renew the CHIP program next week because the threat to kids' health is even more immediate? Even if they extended it on paper for a few months in December, I've seen reports about various states ceasing to sign up new kids, or at least sending letters that they're about to cease signing up new kids because they don't have money in the budget.
So it's not something that they have expressly discussed at this point. They are still remaining focused on the idea that they would get a large package done by the end of next week.
Another one is disaster relief from the intensity of 2017's natural disasters, especially the hurricanes in Florida and Texas and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands and the fires in the West. Is even that kind of politically tribal at this point? Like the Republicans want more for Texas, red state, and the Democrats want more than the Republicans will give easily for Puerto Rico, things like that?
Well, they do plan to include more funding for disaster relief in whatever spending bill they do pass. There's a question also about how much money should be spent, particularly on fires. They are working on a separate legislative fix to the way that fire disaster funding is allocated. So there are still some, it's not necessarily tribal, as you put it, but that there are some outstanding legislative issues that they're still working through.
And yet another item in play is the balance between increased military spending and increased domestic spending, as they lift some previously imposed spending discipline caps on the entire federal budget. And without going into the details of that and recalling the 2013 budget shutdown or government shutdown and budget debacle that led to these spending caps, now I guess they're ready to lift them. But Democrats want parity between domestic spending increases and military spending increases. Republicans don't. What's the parity issue?
So this is, they have actually voted several times to increase the budget cap. So we're put into place as something known as the sequester. People may remember that as the Budget Sequestration Act in 2013. So Congress has voted several times to increase those caps, but they have always increased them at equal levels for military spending and domestic spending. Republicans are now saying they want to have a pretty significant increase in military spending. Democrats say they are absolutely fine with that so long as domestic programs are also funded at that same equal level. That has been an issue, and it has been an issue that has plagued the Republican and Democratic spending negotiations since these spending caps were put into place. And it is definitely still a part of the problem. It's something they have been working on for some time. But as I understand it, the hope is to have an agreement on DACA first before they really lock in the rest of this big, broad package we've been talking about.
Carolyn in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Brian. I heard on this station several weeks ago, I forget which show, that the last time the border wall was expanded was during the Bush Jr. administration, and something like 150 cases were still to this day pending in court because they were for building the wall on private land. Private lands, of course, have to be seized in order to complete this wall. And I'd like to know if there's any discussion among the leaders of Congress, especially those who represent border districts, about the fact that you're seizing an awful lot of private land and the wall might never actually get built because it could be ensnared in court for, you know, decades.
Kelsey?
That is a fair question, and it is something that, you know, not all Republicans support the idea of a border wall. In fact, it is not something that, as far as I can tell, has particularly wide support in Congress. Because of the issues that you raised, there are some issues of eminent domain, there are environmental issues. It raises a lot of problems that would have to be handled, you know, over the course of many years. So it is something that they're very aware of, and that is part of the reason why the discussion that typically happens on the Hill is not about building a wall, but is instead about enforcement techniques that are not a physical concrete wall.
It's so central to the way President Trump campaigned. Can he back down? What are the politics of that? I mean, he didn't have to raise it again last Friday. That's one of the things, right? You can stop talking about something that you campaigned on and then negotiate for something that hints at it or moves in that direction or seems like a down payment on it. You can get to a place where Trump could call it a wall and the Democrats could call it not a wall, just border security. And, you know, you might have a little grumbling on the in the bases of both parties, but then you've made a meaningful compromise for the country and you go on. But by raising it again and with a bigger number than has yet been attached to it, $18 billion over 10 years that he's asking Congress for, it makes it politically more difficult for him to come to some ordinary compromise. Or do people see it differently than that?
Well, this is not a traditional president, and he makes untraditional choices that surprise us often. And this just happens to be one of those times that lawmakers are trying to figure out how to respond and figure out if this is a negotiating position or if this is an actual demand. And that is an open question.
Is there much Republican opposition to the wall based on the fact that it would cost the American taxpayers so much? Republicans don't like big government programs generally, and they like border security generally, but not big government programs with big price tags that, you know, soak the taxpayers. And Trump did campaign by saying Mexico's going to pay for it. So are there Republicans standing up and saying publicly, you said Mexico's going to pay for it. I'm all for the border wall, but only if Mexico pays for it. I don't want to soak my taxpayers at a time when the tax code is changing to begin with, and there's basically net migration from the United States to Mexico, at least the statistics that I've seen, rather than Mexico to the United States. It's less needed than it was in the past for pure illegal crossing purposes. Are there any Republicans saying that?
There have been some Republicans in the past who have made arguments about this being expensive and, you know, bringing up the campaign promise of Mexico paying for the wall. But by and large, the conversation is right now on about trying to get a deal done and not necessarily needling the president.
I don't suppose, to come back to what I started with at the top of the hour, public housing funding is anywhere in this discussion. We have a HUD secretary who sees public housing in general, Ben Carson, as something that just encourages dependency on the government. But we have the mayor of New York, and I'm sure the governor of New York, though I haven't heard it, calling on the federal government to do their fair share in what was, you know, traditionally a federal housing program. Is this a topic of conversation at all?
It may be a topic of conversation in the committees that are relevant to that issue, it's important to understand that the way spending bills are written is they're done by subcommittees of what is known as the Appropriations Committee, and there is a subcommittee on appropriations that deals with this specific issue. But at this point, we're talking about the broad top-line issues of a spending bill, and those need to be agreed to before they hash out the way that money would be allocated to different departments.
So who's at this meeting today between the president and bipartisan Senate leaders if they're trying to hash out this basic spending agreement that includes DACA in some way and some more Republican immigration issues between now and next Friday to avoid a government shutdown? Who's at this meeting this morning?
Well, it's not all senators. It's a House, Senate, and Democrats and Republicans, and they're members of the Trump administration, including General John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, Homeland Security advisors, and Mark Short, who's the assistant to the president who handles legislative affairs. So it is a pretty big group of people. It would take several minutes to list them all off, but it is Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate.
And is that a hopeful sign? I heard one political analyst say that it's, I read in one place, maybe it was even your article, I don't remember, that because it's this big a group, that tends to indicate that they're less serious about coming to a deal. If you want a deal, you put three people in a room and you hash it all out, and then they go back to their groups.
Well, I think that that would be discounting the idea that this is a negotiation that's been ongoing and at many different levels. To consider this the only outreach between the White House and Congress would be a mistake.
Final thing, then. Are the Democrats serious about a possible government shutdown at the end of next week? If they can't strike a deal on DACA, are they debating political pros and cons of that in the 2018 midterm election year?
Well, we saw last week that the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, said that he did not think a shutdown was going to happen, and their focus is on preventing that from happening right now.
Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional reporter. Thank you so much. Really informative.
Thank you.